18. At 2 in the afternoon, Floyd looked up as the brasserie door swung open. He had already looked up several dozen times since ordering his last coffee, as patrons came and went, and there were another 3 empty coffee cups on his table, along with a froth-lined beer glass and the stale crumbs of a nondescript sandwich. It was still raining outside, water sluicing down across the doorframe from a broken gutter above it. The patrons got a soaking when they left or arrived, but no one seemed to complain. Even Greta, when she arrived, seemed more relieved to find him still there than annoyed at the weather. "I thought you'd have gone already," she said, shaking her umbrella. Her clothes were dark with rain, her hair frizzy and tipped with tiny dewdrops. "I figured it was best to keep at the original rendezvous," Floyd said. He removed his coat from the seat opposite, where he had placed it to prevent anyone else from joining him at the table. He had wanted a clear view of the window and of the hotel opposite, in the hope that he might see Verity Auger coming or going. "I must admit, though, that I was beginning to worry I'd got the wrong brasserie. What happened?" "She left," Greta said, sitting down with visible relief. "Almost as soon as I'd put down the telephone, I saw her leaving the hotel. You want a drink? I'd kill for one." Floyd signaled the waiter to their table and ordered another coffee for Greta. "So tell me what happened. You followed her, obviously. Did she look like she was checking out of the hotel?"
"No, she didn't have anything with her other than a handbag. For all I knew, she was going to be back in 5 minutes, but I couldn't take that chance."
"You were right not to. Did you keep up with her?"
"I think I've got a bit better at this tailing business since this morning. I kept my distance and tried to change my appearance every block or so, folding up my umbrella, putting on my hat, sunglasses, that sort of thing. I don't think she saw me."
Greta spooned sugar into the coffee and gulped it down in almost one mouthful.
"Where did she go?" "I followed her all the way to Cardinal Lemoine. That's where I lost her."
"Lost her how?"
"That's the funny thing," Greta said. "I was with her all the way into the metro station. I followed her to the platform and kept my distance. I hid behind some chocolate vending machines. A train came in and then another. She didn't get on either of them, but they were all going in the same direction."
"Weird," Floyd said.
"Not as weird as what happened after that. Between one moment and the next, she disappeared completely. She simply wasn't on the platform."
"And no other train had come and gone?"
Greta lowered her voice, as if aware of how absurd her account sounded. "I'm certain of it. I also know that there is no other exit she could have taken, not without walking right past my hiding place."
Floyd sipped at his own coffee. By the fourth cup, he had ceased tasting it, the drink purely a mechanical aid to his alertness. "She can't just have vanished into thin air."
"I never said she did. It looked that way, but there were a few other people waiting on the platform, and I decided to brazen it out and ask them if they'd seen anything. At this point, I figured I didn't have a lot to lose."
"You were probably right," Floyd said. "What did you get?"
"At least one of the witnesses was certain he'd seen Auger jump down onto the tracks and disappear into the tunnel at the end of the platform."
Floyd digested this while he drained his coffee cup. "There's something about Cardinal Lemoine," he said. "Blanchard said he'd seen Susan White behaving very oddly near that station. He saw her enter the station with a heavy suitcase and come out a few moments later with an empty one. It can't be a coincidence."
"But why would a woman disappear into a metro tunnel?"
"For the same reason anyone else would. There's something in it that matters to them."
"Or else they were both mad," Greta said.
"I can't discount that possibility either. Did you see her come out again?"
"I waited 45 minutes. There was some kind of interruption in the service for a couple of minutes, but then the train started running normally again. Several dozen trains went through. No one came back out of the tunnel."
"And no one thought to report any of this to the station staff or the police?"
"Not the man I was talking to," Greta said. "He wasn't the sort you'd catch doing anything so responsible."
Floyd called for the bill.
"All right. The way I see it, we have 2 choices if we want to find Auger again. We can cover the hotel in case she goes back there, or we can cover Cardinal Lemoine and hope she comes out of the tunnel or goes back in again, if somehow we missed her coming out.
What about the next station up the line? What if she walked all the way through?"
"I'm hoping she didn't. Anyway, that would make even less sense than going into the tunnel in the first place. I can only assume that she must have arranged to drop off or collect something from inside the tunnel.
You talk about covering as if we have limitless manpower, Greta said, whereas in fact we have two people, and one of them needs to be looking after her aunt.
I know, Floyd said, and I won't ask anything else of you. What you've done already has been a great help.
But I lost her, Greta said.
No, you established that there's something going on with Verity Auger that doesn't fit with her story. Until now, there was still a faint chance that she might have been telling the truth about being Susan White's long-lost sister. And now?
Floyd wiped his upper lip clean of the mustache of coffee froth that had gathered there.
Now? Now I'd put good money on both of them being spies.
You're in much too deep, Greta said. If Custine was here, he'd tell you exactly the same thing. Take what you have and hand it over to the right people, Floyd. They have no axe to grind with you.
I have to get Custine off the hook, Greta, and the only way I'm going to do that is by following this woman.
You liked her, didn't you?
Floyd reached for his coat. She wasn't my type.
Maybe so, but you liked her all the same.
Floyd shook his head, laughing at the thought of it, but he couldn't look Greta in the eye.
In the armored glass bulb of the recovery bubble, the status lights of the transit ship blinked on and off with hypnotic regularity.
Rotating, Skalsgård said, leaning against one of the high-level consoles. You sure about this, Auger?
Just tell me what to do. I'll take care of the rest.
The B-striped holding cradle began to swivel, turning the ship through 180 degrees. Unlike the gleaming machinery surrounding it, the transit ship looked like some impossibly battered relic from a museum of space history, the kind of capsule that would have been flown back from space by seat-of-the-pants jockeys, relying on grit and slide rule calculations to get themselves home.
Auger had to remind herself that the ship had accrued all this damage during a single passage between portals, and that it would be approximately twice as battered by the time it emerged on Phobos, about 30 hours from now.
Ship looks healthy enough, Skalsgård said, tapping through monitor options, which is a good thing. We have enough problems with the throat without having to worry about the ship as well.
You think you can last all the way home?
Skalsgård nodded. I'll make it. It's not as if I have much of a choice, is it?
This is the way it has to happen, Auger said, but that doesn't mean I don't want a rescue party launched the instant you get through.
They'll be on their way as soon as is humanly possible. You have my word on that.
All right. Let's get you strapped in.
Auger helped Skalsgård along the high-level catwalk that led to the airlock set into the side of the recovery bubble. Skalsgård was getting weaker, Auger noticed. Even with the attention she had received from the first aid kit, she was clearly sliding towards unconsciousness. Auger just hoped she could get the woman underway before that happened. She was still hoping for another run-through of the commands required to keep the throat from sphinctering tight. The airlock clammed open on heavy-duty piston-driven hinges. Auger barely remembered dragging herself out of the ship. It seemed so long ago. Gently, she assisted Skalsgård through the lock and into the pressurized connecting bridge that crossed to the waiting ship.
I think maybe I should splint that leg before I zip you in, Auger said.
No time. I don't want to delay your rescue by 1 second more than is necessary. Anyway, they might have shredded me pretty good, but I don't think anything's broken. Stop worrying on my account, all right? You've already helped me enough.
Inside the ship was the arrangement of 3 acceleration couches Auger had come to know so well on the way over. Blotting out the woman's moans of discomfort, she laid Skalsgård on the right-hand couch, buckled the restraints securely around her, and then folded down the navigation and communications panel. Auger reached for the loose tangle of the in-flight catheter system, assuming Skalsgård would not have the strength to crawl back to the tiny toilet.
You want me to plug you in before you fly?
I'll manage, Skalsgård said, grimacing. And if I don't, I think my dignity will take it. You have any thoughts about what I should tell Kaliskan when I get back?
Auger reached into her jacket and took out the one piece of paper she had been able to salvage from the attack.
Can you hold out a minute? I need to write something down.
Just in case I fall into a coma?
That's one consideration, but I also need to write something down for myself.
Auger left the ship and returned to one of the high-level consoles, where she had seen a notepad and pen. She ripped out a clean sheet of paper and wrote down everything she thought she had gleaned from Susan White's paperwork. Then she unfolded the piece of paper she had retrieved from the tunnel, the letter from the manufacturing works in Berlin. She flattened the letter on the desk
and on another sheet of paper took down the particulars of the plant, including the address and the name of the man who had written to White. Then she jogged back to the ship, relieved to find Skelskad still conscious. "This is the only piece of documentation the war baby didn't make off within the tunnel," she said, slipping the letter into Skelskad's chest pocket. "Don't forget it's there."
"I won't."
Orga then folded the sheet containing her observations and placed it with the letter. "This is everything I've figured out so far. It's not much, but maybe Kalaskan can work out what's going on. Anyway, I might know a bit more when I get back from Berlin."
"Who said anything about Berlin?"
"I'm following one of the leads Susan White never got around to herself." Skelskad shook her head warningly.
"That's extremely dangerous. In Paris, you're never more than an hour away from the portal if anything goes wrong. How long will it take you to get back from Berlin?"
"It doesn't matter. The portal's no use to me until the ship returns. I'm pretty sure I can make it to Berlin and back in plenty of time."
"You mean you don't know for certain?"
"I haven't had time to plan this to the last detail," Orga said. "All I know is that there's a lead in Berlin, and Susan would have followed it up if she hadn't been killed. I owe it to her to do what I can. There's an overnight train leaving tonight, and I plan to be on it. I'll be in Berlin by tomorrow morning, and with any luck, I'll be on my way back by the evening."
"With any luck," Skelskad echoed.
"Look, don't worry about me. Just get yourself home and make sure Kalaskan sees those pieces of paper. I have a feeling the letter is more important than any of us realize." Skelskad squeezed Orga's hand.
"You really don't have to send me back instead of you."
"I know, but I do appreciate it. It's a brave thing you're doing." Orga squeezed the other woman's hand in return.
"Listen, it's no big hardship. It gives me a chance to see a bit more of this world before they pull me out of it for good."
"You almost sound convincing."
"I mean it. As much as part of me would love to be riding that ship back with you, there's another part that just wants to soak up as much of E2 as I can. I've barely scratched the surface, Skelskad. That's all any of us has done."
"Take good care of yourself, Orga."
"I will."
Orga stood back from the cabin.
"All right, let's close you up and get this show on the road. You're clear on those throat adjustments. If the ride gets bumpy, you'll know why."
"Reassuring as ever."
Orga pushed the door until it was nearly closed, then stepped away as servo motors completed the job. Only a few inches of armored metal now separated her from Skelskad, but she suddenly felt vastly more alone. She walked back through the airlock, then ran through the sequence of umbilical disconnection commands, ending with the retraction of the connecting bridge. Through the scuffed and scratched window in the side of the ship, Skelskad gave her a final thumbs up. Orga walked back to the main ring of consoles and tried to blank everything from her mind except the procedure necessary for dispatching the ship. None of the individual steps were particularly difficult. Initial throat stabilization and launch were handled by a pre-programmed routine that worked exactly as advertised. In the translucent bronze structures of the alien machinery, the suspended sparks and filaments of amber light quickened their movements almost imperceptibly. The surrounding clots and plaques of human machinery throbbed and flickered with red and green status lights and indicator numerals. On the console before her, analog dials lurched hard into the red, but she had been told to expect this and kept her nerve. The grilled catwalk beneath her feet began to vibrate. She increased the power to the throat machines, and a metal toolkit slid off a console halfway across the room, spilling spanners and torque wrenches to the ground and making her jump. On the panel, a sequence of lights changed one by one to orange. Throat aperture was now wide enough to accept the ship. The geodesic stress indices were low enough not to rip it to shreds, provided it plunged straight down the middle without grazing the sides. Orga found a pair of protective goggles and bent the stalk of a microphone to her lips.
"You getting all this, Skelskad?"
Her reply buzzed from a grilled speaker in the console. It sounded thin and distant, as if she was hundreds of kilometers away.
"Everything looks okay from in here. Let's get this over with."
Orga checked that the orange lights were holding steady.
"Injecting in 5 seconds. Spare me the countdown. Just do it."
"Here goes, then."
The movement was more violent than Orga had been expecting. The cradle suddenly lurched forward, propelling the ship faster and faster. In an eye blink, cradle and ship had exited the main globe of the recovery bubble, the entire structure creaking in response to the sudden transfer of momentum.
From her vantage point, Auger watched the ship herring down the mirror-lined injection tunnel, picking up speed like a torpedo. 2 or 3 seconds later, the cradle reached the limit of its guidance rail and slammed to a halt, lobbing the ship ahead of it on the lazy arc of a ballistic trajectory. The throat of the wormhole, exposed now that the iris had opened, was a vortex of blue and violet static discharge just ahead of the ship, gaping like the mouth of a starfish. Spring-loaded arms whipped out from the ship's sides and glanced against the incurving wall, spitting coils of light and molten metal. An instant later, they sheared away, warped into toffee-like shapes. But they'd done the work they were designed for, nudging the transport out of harm's way. With a final shower of golden sparks, the ship picked up yet more speed at an impossible rate, diminishing to a dot of light in a heartbeat. All round her, emergency klaxons and warning strobes had come on. A recorded voice began to repeat a message about unsustainable power levels. Above the din, she heard a distant voice. "Auger, you reading this?" Auger leaned closer to the microphone, checking her watch at the same time. "Guess you're on your way. How was it?" "Interesting." Skelskad's voice was already breaking up, becoming thready. Routing communications through the link was difficult enough when there was no ship en route, but it was almost impossible otherwise. "Skelskad, I don't know if you can hear me now, but I'm going to start controlled constriction of the throat in about 15 seconds. The microphone crackled in reply, but it was nothing Auger could understand. It made no difference now in any case. The die was cast. She descended the spiral staircase to the lower console, checked her watch and began to drop the stabilizing power as Skelskad had instructed her. When she had notched it down sufficiently, the klaxon strobes and recorded warnings turned themselves off, leaving her with only the warm hum of the surrounding machinery. The amber sparks and filaments had quietened themselves. She returned to the higher level and peered down the injection shaft, but there was no sign of the departed ship. Instead, the cradle was returning to the recovery bubble, while a circular sweeper mechanism was clearing the tube of any lingering debris from the mangled guidance arms. "Skelskad, Moria," she said into the microphone. But there was no answer. Auger checked her watch and counted ahead 60 hours. Someone might route a signal down the link once Skelskad was home, but in all likelihood, Auger would not know whether she had been successful until a new ship dropped into the bubble. She did not want to be in Berlin when that happened. Auger's third passage through the sensor was as uneventful as the first two. She shivered and picked herself up, then set about gathering the things she would need for the rest of her mission. She found a torch that worked, then stuffed clean clothes and bundles of local currency into a red suitcase. She had retrieved the automatic from Skelskad and found a fresh clip of ammunition on one of the storage racks in the sensor chamber. Now the automatic nestled in her handbag, next to the war baby weapon. It was good to feel armed as she started the slow and filthy walk back to the station. After 10 minutes, she had reached the Metro tunnel, the torch picking out the lethal gleam of the electrified rails. Her breath caught in her throat. She had forgotten all about the electricity. With Aveling and the others gone, there was no one to short-circuit the supply while she got clear of the tunnel. It would be nearly a dozen hours before the train stopped running for the night, and then she would have the additional problem of escaping from a locked metro station. If she couldn't get out until the station was opened again the next morning, assuming no one arrested her for suspicious behavior in the meantime, she would have wasted almost a day's worth of the 60 hours available before the ship returned. She could probably find a way to short-circuit the track, but not to restore the power once she was free of the tunnel. And if it wasn't restored, there would be too much danger of metro engineers poking around in the tunnel, with the risk of them finding the entrance to the tunnel leading to the portal. Auger waited in the sanctuary of the secondary tunnel until a train passed by. The brightly lit carriages slammed past only inches from her face, Auger squinting against the warm slap of disturbed air. Another train roared through a couple of minutes later, its compartments empty except for a few commuters. The midday rush was over now, but the trains continued to run on the same schedule. She cursed the metro system for its mindless dedication to efficiency. There was no alternative. She would just have to make a run for it. She guessed that she would have a minute and a half to reach Cardinal Lemoine, 2 if she was lucky, and could only hope that she would not trip or find herself caught in the tunnel if a train arrived sooner than expected. Just get it over with, Orga told herself. She would make a dash for it as soon as the next train had passed through. She readied herself, anxious not to waste a second. But after a minute, no train came. And then another minute passed. And then another. She waited in the tunnel for 5 minutes, until she heard the approach of another train as it squealed and clattered towards her. In that 5 minute interval, she could easily have reached safety. But the next two trains arrived in rapid succession, almost nose to tail. She would just have to take her chances. Even as the red lights of the most recent train were disappearing into the tunnel, she was on her way. She kept her back to the wall, her coat snagging on the tangled pipes and electrical conduits that ran along the tunnel. She held the suitcase as high as her strength allowed, trailing it behind her. It thumped and scraped against the wall as she moved. She had not tripped before, she told herself, and she had managed to make the distance in the time Aveling had given her. Nothing had changed, except that the punishment for even the slightest slip would be rather more severe. She could not afford to make a single mistake. One misplaced footstep and it was all over. How long had it been now? Down the tunnel, just around a shallow curve, she could make out the cold glow of Cardinal Lemoine station. It still seemed very far away, further than she could possibly cover in the minute or so that must be remaining. Orga panicked. Had she got turned around somehow? Was she in fact heading deeper into the tunnel, lured by the impossibly distant light of the next station down the line? The panic brought a lump to her throat and an appalling desire to turn around and head in the other direction. No, she ordered herself sternly. Just keep moving. The passing trains had confirmed that she was moving in the right direction, and even if this was the wrong direction, she was committed now. She had no better chance of making it to safety in the other direction than if she continued to press on the way she was going. And as she edged closer to the light, placing each foot with tense deliberation, she began to feel as if she was making slow but steady progress. The light was now much brighter, glancing off the courses of enameled tiles lining the mouth of the tunnel. She could make out people standing on the platform, none of whom had noticed her yet. The suitcase bumped against the wall behind her, dislodging a loose chip of tunnel cladding. Then the people began to move, drifting to the edge of the platform as if by a collective decision. Almost as soon as she had noticed this, the brilliant headlights of a train hove into view. It came to a stop at the platform, paused for what seemed only a handful of seconds, and then began moving in her direction. She wasn't going to make it. As the train entered her stretch of tunnel, arcs danced between the electrified rails and the undercarriage of the train. The arcs were a cruel violet blue, the color of the wormhole mouth she had glimpsed earlier. The train lurched and swayed as it approached, seeming to fill the entire width of the tunnel. Orga wished she had paid more attention on the way in, checking the wall for nooks and crannies in which she might have taken shelter. Now all she could do was stand still and press herself against the wall as hard as possible. Pipes and conduits dug into her spine like the torments of some apparatus of medieval justice. She pressed harder, trying to become part of the fabric of the wall, willing herself to melt into it like some camouflaged reptile. The train roared closer, rats scampering and garbage fluttering away in the air draft pushed before it. Surely she thought the driver must see her now, but the train kept coming, its steely roar filling her universe like a proclamation. Orga closed her eyes, no sense in keeping them open until the last moment. The roar reached a crescendo, oil and dust hitting her lungs. She felt a violent jolt run through her left arm, as if the train had wrenched it from her shoulder. The roar continued, and then began to abate. Reverberations chased the train along the tunnel, and then all was quiet again. Orga opened her eyes and dared to breathe. She was all right. Her arm was still attached, and it didn't even feel dislocated. But the suitcase was lying half open a dozen paces further back down the tunnel. The clean clothes she had packed for herself were draped over the nearest pair of rails, already crusted with filth. Two packets of counterfeit money lay between the tracks, while a third had ended up much further along the tunnel, at the limit of her torch's beam. Orga grabbed the nearest bundle of money, but some instinct told her to abandon everything else and get out of the tunnel as quickly as possible. She doubted the money would be there when she returned to the portal, but there was plenty more where it had come from. Someone, most probably a poorly paid metro engineer, would be enjoying a generous bonus. She reached the end of the tunnel just as the next train was slowing into Cardinal Lemoine. She lingered in the darkness until the train came to a stop, and the passengers on the platform began to jostle for the best positions around the sliding doors. The driver picked up a newspaper from the top of his control panel and turned idly to the back page, taking a pencil from behind his ear to scribble something down. Auger used his moment of inattention to spring up onto the platform. Most of the disembarking passengers had already left the train and were spilling in ragged lines towards the exit. If she could only mingle with them, she thought she had a good chance of reaching daylight without anyone noticing that she had not in fact come off the train. But there was a wide expanse of open platform to cross before she reached the small crowd, and there were at least four seated bystanders she would have to pass by unnoticed. The doors hissed shut, and the train started moving. Auger walked as nonchalantly as she could along the platform, fixated on reaching the safety of the scurrying crowd. Once she was above ground, she would be safe. Just another woman fallen on hard times, someone to be actively ignored. "Mademoiselle, this way, please." The Frenchman's voice was calm but authoritative. She looked around for the source, and saw one of the seated individuals rising and moving towards her with a determined look in his eyes. He had been reading a newspaper, but had left it on the bench, now revealing himself to be wearing the dark blue uniform of a metro official. He was jamming his hat on as he spoke. "I'm sorry," Auger replied, answering him in French. "Mademoiselle, you must come with me. I am afraid we must ask some questions of you." "I don't understand. What have I done?" "That is to be determined." He pointed to a nearby door marked with a no-entry sign. "If you would step into our office, please. It would be best for all concerned if you do not make a scene." She did not move. The official was a short, middle-aged man with a graying mustache and a pink nose, marked by complex tributaries of broken veins. He most definitely did not want a scene, Auger thought. "I still don't quite..." "We had reports of a young woman entering the tunnel an hour or two ago," he said in a low voice. "We were inclined to dismiss them, but there were at least two witnesses. As a matter of precaution, I decided to keep watch on the tunnel myself in case anyone emerged." "But you didn't see anyone emerge," Auger insisted. "Not me, certainly. I just got off that train. I know what I saw." "Then you must be mistaken." He shifted uncomfortably, doubtless wondering if he should use force to persuade her into the room, or call for assistance from another official. "Please, do not make this difficult for me," he said. "We have every right to call in the police. If there is a simple explanation, however, that may not be necessary." "Is there a problem here?" asked another voice, differently accented. Auger looked around. Another passenger was walking towards them, hands in the pockets of his long grey raincoat. He wore a fedora with the brim tipped low over his face, but she recognized him immediately. "Wendell," she said. "What's going on, Verity?" She had no idea what was going on, but Floyd seemed to expect her to fall into a role, one for which only he had seen the script. Stumbling over her words, she said, "I'm not sure, Floyd, but this man wants to take me into that room and ask me some questions." Floyd examined the man with a look of patient concern. "Why on earth would you want to do that?" "Do you know this woman, sir?"
"Know her? I should think so. She's my wife."
"Then perhaps you could kindly explain what she was doing crawling around in the tunnel."
"I have no idea what you're talking about," Floyd said.
He took off his hat, smoothing down his hair. The man scratched his veined bulb of a nose.
"I know what I saw. Perhaps it would be best for us to continue this discussion in my office."
"As you wish," Floyd said, "but I assure you that you're making a very serious mistake."
Auger sighed. "Come on, Wendell. Let's get this over with, and then perhaps this silly little man will leave us alone."
The man let them walk ahead of him, then used a key on a chain to unlock the faded green door into a bare, Spartan private office. A single unshaded bulb hung from the ceiling like the lure of an anglerfish. "Sit here," the man said, indicating a warped wooden table and a couple of pull-up chairs that had seen better days.
"I'll stand if you don't mind," Floyd said. "Now let me explain. 30 minutes ago, I received a telephone call from my wife. She works in a haberdasher's on Gay-Lussac. All sorts of people visit the shop, and occasionally the staff let customers use the upstairs washroom. Unfortunately, someone left the tap running. Why don't you tell him the rest, Verity?"
"The sink overflowed," Auger said, watching for the minutest nod of encouragement from Floyd. "The water built up and made the ceiling cave in.
Everyone working below was either drenched or covered in dust and debris from the collapsing floor. That's why I look like this. All our stock was ruined. I called my husband and told him we were all being sent home early from work, and he came to the station to meet me. I don't want to wander the streets alone in this state. Neither of you is French, the man said, as if imparting grave news. There's no law against it, Floyd replied. Anyway, you're welcome to look at my identification papers. He showed the man his identity card, and one of the false business cards he kept handy for occasions just like this. As you can see, my work as a literary translator means I spend most of the day in my own home. Go on, Verity. Show the good man your papers as well. Here, she said, holding them out after rummaging in her handbag. He looked at her documents, which were grubby with her fingerprints. Verity Auger, he read. I shall remember that name. I shall also remember that neither of you is wearing a wedding ring. Beyond the closed door, another train arrived in the station. Auger was tempted to make a dash for it, but she feared that the official would be able to stop the train from departing. Look, she said, I'm telling the truth, and so is my husband. What business would I have crawling around in a railway tunnel? It was bad enough taking the train looking like this, with everyone staring at me as if I was some kind of tramp. I assure you, everything's above board, Floyd said, smiling winningly. As my wife says, she'd hardly be likely to crawl around in a metro tunnel. Someone was crawling around in it, the man insisted. That may be the case, Floyd said, his tone conciliatory. But surely you can't suspect every woman who steps off a train with a bit of dust on their clothes. I saw her, the man began, but his voice lacked conviction. I saw someone come out of that tunnel. And in the rush of passengers coming and going, you must have lost track of the right person and ended up confusing them with my wife. Floyd sounded very understanding. Look, I don't want to make things difficult for you, but my wife really needs to be getting home, where she can have a hot shower and change her clothes. He took Auger's hand. His fingers were rough but gentle. Don't you, dear? I'm worried about whether there'll be a job for me to go back to tomorrow, Auger said. The damage to the stock looked very bad. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Floyd returned his attention to the official. Here, you've been very understanding. Will you accept this as a token of my thanks? He had taken a 10-franc note from inside his coat, folded it discreetly in two, and slipped it into the man's top pocket, almost without blinking. Your thanks? For what? I've done nothing. My wife is still a bit embarrassed about her appearance, Floyd said, lowering his voice as if the two men were sharing a confidence. She'd be grateful if you'd let us leave the station by the staff exit. I couldn't, possibly. Floyd slipped the man another 10-franc note. It's highly irregular, I know, but we really would appreciate it. Treat yourself to a drink on me. The man pursed his lips, weighing possibilities. He reached a conclusion very quickly. Stock damage, did you say? We just moved everything in from the warehouse, Auger said. I hope very much that your job will be safe, madame. He opened the wooden door and ushered them back out onto the platform. This way, he said, leading them in the opposite direction from the public exit. You're a very good man, Floyd said. I won't forget you in a hurry. You can be sure that I won't forget you in a hurry either, Monsieur Floyd.
19. It was still raining when they reached street level, but it was the last dregs of mid-afternoon drizzle, and the grey blanket of the sky was punctured by odd-shaped splashes of pastel blue. After all that happened underground, the mundane continuation of city life, the constant welter of pedestrians and vehicles, felt to Auger like a peculiar kind of insult. She waited until the official had returned to his subterranean world, locking a gate behind him, before speaking to Floyd. I don't know where to begin, she said, addressing him in English now. You can begin by thanking me. I got you out of a fix down there. That fix wasn't any of your business. What were you doing following me like that? I wasn't following you, Floyd said. I just happened to see you in trouble. You just happened to see me. Of all the metro stations in the city, you just happened to be passing the time of day in Cardinal Lemoyne. Floyd shrugged. Well, not exactly. Auger started walking away from him, raising her hand in the probably vain hope of catching a taxi.
In her state, they were more likely to speed up than slow down.
Where are you going? Floyd asked, his tone reasonable.
Anywhere but here. Anywhere I think there's a chance I won't be followed by a nosy man in a shabby raincoat.
Is that how they teach you to show gratitude in Dakota?
She swung around, teetering a little on her heels. The pavement beneath her was slick and slate-colored with rain. I'm not ungrateful, she said, glaring at him, but my gratitude ends here. Now please walk away, or I'll have to call the police.
In your state, I'd like to see you try.
A taxi sped by, making a special point of sluicing her with dirty brown rainwater. Just get away from me, she said, screwing up her face as the water seeped into her shoes. We concluded our business this morning. Or don't you remember the nice termination fee I gave you?
Some of that termination fee just bailed you out of trouble, Floyd replied.
I wasn't worried about him. I was handling things perfectly well until you barged in.
He was right, though, wasn't he?
Floyd looked at her with an amused expression. He had very deep wrinkles around his eyes. He was a man who either laughed a lot or cried a lot.
Right about what? You did go into that tunnel. There's no point denying it. I had a tail on you from the moment you left my offices.
I noticed her, Auger said. I hate to break the bad news, but she isn't very good.
She's cheap. The point is that she saw you duck into that tunnel, the one our friend claimed you just came out of.
I thought you said you weren't following me.
And I wasn't, not personally. But given what I learned, I wondered if it might be informative to sit and wait in Cardinal Lemoine. Gradually she felt some of her anger abating, or perhaps being put away for later use. In a softer voice she said,
Why exactly did you help me?
You had nothing to lose by letting that man hand me over to the authorities, which is most likely exactly what he would have done.
Nothing to lose, Floyd said, except that they'd never have got to the bottom of whatever it is you're up to.
And do you think you have a better chance of that?
I'm halfway there, he said.
Well, that makes two of us, she said sotto voce.
I'm sorry?
She shook her head. I don't think you're a bad man, Wendell, but I do know that this isn't something you want to get involved in.
He narrowed one eye. Now that's hardly the kind of thing you should say if you want me off your case.
Another taxi made a concerted effort to drench her. She stepped away from the curb, closer to Floyd.
But why are you on my case? I told you who I am. I explained all about my sister.
Floyd took out a narrow sliver of wood and placed it between his teeth. He bit down on it, making a dry, cracking sound.
You did, and it sounded mighty plausible, for about 30 seconds.
Then why did you let me walk out of your office with the tin?
Floyd winked at her.
Have a guess. And while you're at it, why don't I drive you somewhere? You can get warm and dry and put some color back into your cheeks.
Thanks, but I'll take my chances with the taxis. Failing that, I'll walk. Or construct some sort of raft.
My car's just around this corner. I can take you to your hotel or to my office. Either option would offer you a change of clothes and some warm water.
No, she said, turning away from him again.
Just at that moment, a heavy truck roared past, pushing a tidal wave of toffee-colored water along the road ahead of it.
Auger let out a little shriek of exasperation as a filthy spray enveloped her from head to foot.
As the truck veered past, the driver offered a consolatory wave of his hand, as if everything that had just happened was an act of divine fate far beyond his own control.
Take me to the hotel, she said. Please.
At your service, Floyd replied. From Cardinal Lemoine, Floyd took Saint-Germain and Saint-Michel boulevards, until he reached the nexus of intersecting streets around Montparnasse. The few patches of clear sky that had emerged a little while ago had shriveled away again, as if deciding that the effort simply wasn't worth it. The rain had stopped, but the entire city huddled under a swollen mass of ominous clouds that seethed and circulated overhead like so many prowling wolves.
You have to understand things from my point of view, Floyd said, glancing at his passenger in the rearview mirror. He seemed to be taking his chauffeur duties very seriously, and had insisted that she ride in the back, where there was more room.
I was taken on to solve a case. It doesn't matter to me that the man who hired me is now dead. Until the case is closed, I have a duty to find out what happened. All the more so, now that my partner is under suspicion of murder.
But I already told you, she began.
You already told me a pack of lies designed to get me to hand over the box, Floyd said. Let's start at the beginning, shall we? I'd keep your eyes on the road if I were you.
He ignored the remark. Take this business about you and your sister coming from Dakota.
What of it?
You might have fooled Blanchard, but your accent isn't anything I recognize. I'm not even sure you're American.
You obviously don't know your own country very well.
Olga shifted in her seat, rearranging the damp folds of her coat. By your own admission, you've been in Paris for 20 years. That's easily long enough to have become out of touch.
If you're from Dakota, then I'm far more out of touch than I thought.
I can hardly be blamed for your ignorance. Tanglewood is a very small community, and we have our own way of doing things. Have you ever met Mennonites or Amish or Pennsylvania Dutch?
Floyd steered the car on to Boulevard Edgar Quinet, skirting the huge cemetery at Montparnasse.
Not lately, he said.
Well then,
Auger said, as if this settled the matter conclusively.
The play of cloud-filtered light across the cemetery illuminated a huddle of mourners taking turns to cast flowers into the open pit of a grave. Their umbrellas merged into a single black canopy, like a private thundercloud.
Well, what?
If you'd met any of those people, I'm sure you'd find their accents and manners just as out of the ordinary as my own. Small communities breed their own ways.
Tanglewood must be very small indeed. Did I tell you I couldn't find it in the Gazetteer?
I don't recall.
Anyway, Floyd said, I can't begin to imagine what business a girl from a small town in Dakota would have in a Paris metro tunnel. Or her sister, for that matter.
He met her eyes in the mirror. The thing is, Susan White also had a thing about Cardinal Lemoine. She was observed entering the station with a heavy suitcase, and leaving with a light one.
If there's a significance to that, I'm afraid it quite escapes me.
According to the late Mr. Blanchard, and judging by what I saw when he let me into her room, your sister had a mania for collecting things. Her room was a holding area for huge numbers of books, magazines and newspapers, maps and telephone directories. It looked as if she collected just about anything she could get her hands on.
Floyd waited a beat. Pretty odd behavior for a tourist.
She liked souvenirs.
By the ton?
Olga leaned forward. He smelled her perfume. It made him think of roses and spring.
What exactly are you saying, Mr. Floyd? Let's get it out into the open, shall we?
He turned the car onto Boulevard Pasteur, slowing down behind a bus carrying an advertisement for Cronenberg beer.
Your sister's actions simply don't add up.
I already told you she had mental problems.
But Blanchard got to know her pretty well, and he never suspected that there was anything wrong with her head.
Paranoiacs can be very manipulative.
What if she wasn't paranoid at all? What if all that was just a story you've tried to sell me to throw me off the scent?
You're saying that my sister's actions might have had some rational explanation.
Miss Auger. They were off first-name terms now. No more Verity, no more Wendell. I just watched you crawl out of a metro tunnel. Right now, I'm about ready to believe anything, up to and including the possibility that the two of you were not sisters at all, but fellow spies.
So now we're getting to it, she said, rolling her eyes in disbelief.
Let's look at the facts, shall we?
Floyd continued, unperturbed. Susan White obviously wasn't acting alone. She must have had an accomplice, whom she met with in Cardinal Lemoine. The accomplice made the suitcase switch, or emptied the one White was carrying and took the contents away. My guess is that the accomplice then made their way into that selfsame tunnel you just came out of. There's obviously something in there that means a great deal to you.
Go on, she said, her tone mocking. Let's hear the rest of your preposterous little theory.
It isn't a whole theory yet, just the start of one. I still want to hear what you think you've got.
My partner found something odd in Susan White's room. The wireless set had been altered, probably by Susan herself. It looks as if she was using it to receive instructions, or perhaps to tap into communications between rival spies.
Ah, so now we've got two groups of spies. It gets better, it really does.
Christine never did crack the code. Turns out his attempts were futile anyway. Susan was using an Enigma machine.
I'm quite sure that means something to you, but
it's a sophisticated enciphering machine, which makes me think she was a spy.
So what does that make you?
You're being totally absurd.
Except I'm not the one who just crawled out of a metro tunnel.
For a long while, Olga said nothing at all.
Floyd took Boulevard Garibaldi as far as Place Cambronne, and then steered onto Emile Zola, heading towards Auger's hotel.
Look, she said, I can't expect you to understand any of this, but everything I told you about my sister was the truth. However, it's also true that she had some kind of fixation with Cardinal Lemoyne Station. I told you she believed forces were moving against her, didn't I?
Maybe you did, he allowed.
I can't explain the wireless or that machine you mentioned, except to say that if you listen to the radio these days, there are a lot of odd transmissions, and who knows where she found that machine. I take it this is something you can buy if you want one badly enough?
Get to your point, Miss Auger.
My point, she continued, is that it's more than likely that my sister picked up one of these odd radio channels and absorbed it into her private conspiracy. As for the tunnel, well, I can't deny that she thought there was something down there. She mentioned it more than once in her postcards. She also mentioned that she had hidden something valuable in there. Whether she had or not, I couldn't say, but I knew I wouldn't be able to leave Paris without finding out for myself.
And this didn't strike you as being just the slightest bit dangerous?
Of course I knew it was dangerous, and of course I couldn't very well tell the man in the station what I was doing.
Floyd's hands tightened on the steering wheel.
So that's all it was? Just tidying up some of your sister's unfinished business?
Yes, she said emphatically.
It still doesn't explain why there have been two deaths. Got a neat explanation for that as well, have you? As you already said yourself, Blanchard probably felt guilty about what had happened to Susan. Perhaps her death was an accident after all. Those low railings look unsafe to me.
Floyd slowed the car to a crawl as they neared the hotel, looking for a suitable parking spot. The bad weather had brought everyone out in their cars, with only a few brave souls chancing the sidewalks.
You know what? He said. I'm half tempted to believe you. I'd like nothing more than to close this case with a clear conscience. Maybe you are exactly who you say you are, and all the suspicious circumstances I keep seeing are just red herrings left behind by your sister.
Now you're beginning to talk sense, Auger said.
There's a woman in my life who wants to leave France, Floyd said. She wants me to pack my bags and leave with her. A large part of me wants to go with her.
Maybe you should listen to that large part.
I'm listening, Floyd said, and right now the only thing that's keeping me here is the thought that I might be turning my back on something big. That, and the fact that my partner is in a lot of trouble with the police, and will be until this case is closed.
Don't get sucked into Susan's games, Auger said.
Making an obvious effort to sound uninterested, she asked, So who is this woman anyway?
You've met her.
Floyd had spotted a parking space. He crunched the Mathis into reverse and prepared to ease the massive car into an available space, thinking of the car as a coal barge and the space as a vacant berth.
She's the woman who followed you from my office.
The cleaning girl?
The cleaning girl, yeah, except she isn't a cleaning girl. Her name's Greta and she's a jazz musician. Good at her job, too.
She's pretty. You should go with her.
Easy as that, is it?
There's nothing to keep you in Paris, Wendell.
He looked at her. We're back on Wendell now, are we?
I've seen the state of your office. Business isn't exactly booming. I'm sorry about your partner, but I assure you, there really isn't a case to be investigated here.
The Mathis's rear fender kissed the front fender of a dented Citroën behind them. Floyd slipped the car into first gear and was inching it forward when Auger suddenly lunged hard across the back seat, away from the side nearest the hotel.
Drive, she said.
Floyd looked back at her.
What? Get out of here, fast.
I can't. I have to pick up Greta.
Wendell, just drive.
Something in her voice made him obey her without further question. He lurched the Mathis out of the parking space, not minding that he scraped the car in front of him in the process. He just had time to glance towards the lobby of the hotel and see the small child standing on the steps immediately in front of the door, playing with a yo-yo. The child was male, wearing shorts and a t-shirt and shiny buckled shoes over white socks, but there was nothing boyish about the child's face. Floyd would never have given the boy a moment's attention had Auger not been so obviously alarmed, but now that he looked more closely, he saw that his face was wrinkled and cadaverous, a withered parody of a child's. The boy looked towards them and smiled.
The boy?
Just get us out of here, Auger said. Across the street, the glass door to a brasserie swung open. Greta rushed out with her coat bundled over one arm, a waiter following her with a tray in his hand and a bewildered look on his face. Greta turned around without stopping and threw some money towards him. Floyd hit the brakes. "What are we waiting for?" Orga asked, her alarm increasing. She leaned forward anxiously and grasped the back of Floyd's seat, trying to see what was holding them up. Floyd leaned over and popped the front passenger side door. "Make that who, not what. I had Greta watching the Royale in case I didn't pick you up in Cardinal Lemoine." Floyd's attention darted back to the boy. He had reeled in his yo-yo and was taking slow, thoughtful steps towards the car. Behind the Mathis, a queue of vehicles was already making its impatience known. "We can't wait any longer," Orga said, her knuckles white on the seat back. Floyd signaled to Greta to move faster. She slipped behind the Mathis and slid in through the passenger side door, pushing wet strands of black hair from her brow. Even before she had pulled the door shut, Floyd had the car moving again, picking up speed towards the Mirabeau Bridge. At the intersection with the Quayside Road, he swung the car back north towards the Eiffel Tower. The low clouds had snipped off the top of the structure, as if it had never been completed. "Would someone mind telling me what's going on?" Greta asked, pushing her coat over the back of the seat. "I found Miss Auger." Greta looked at the woman in the back of the car. "So I gathered. But why the sudden excitement?" "She told me to drive," Floyd said. "She sounded as if she meant it." "And you just do whatever she says?" Floyd caught Auger's eye in the rearview mirror. "Is it safe now?" "Just keep driving," she said. "Since you made a point of not crossing the river, I presume you're taking us back to your office."
"Unless you have a better idea," he replied. "What happened back there? What made it unsafe for us to hang around?"
Auger shook her head once.
"It doesn't matter. Just drive."
"It was the boy with the yo-yo," Floyd said. "Wasn't it?"
"Don't be ridiculous."
He turned to Greta. "You kept a good watch on the hotel since I left."
"No, Floyd. I painted my fingernails and browsed fashion magazines. What do you think I was doing?"
"Did you see the boy?"
"Yes," Greta said, after a moment's consideration. "I did, and I didn't like the look of him either."
From the back seat of the car, Auger watched Floyd check the mirror as he turned the car into Rue du Dragon. It was now late afternoon, and the street had already taken on something of the gloom of evening. Auger found it difficult to believe that only 7 hours had passed since she had paid a visit to the detective's office. It might as well have been weeks ago, for all she had in common with the determined and confident version of herself who had walked out of the building, prize in hand. She had thought that the mission was all but finished, barring the trivial business of returning to the portal. You poor, pitiable fool, Auger thought. Had she stood face to face with her former self, she would have slapped her cheek and laughed in spite.
"I don't see any nasty-looking children," Floyd said.
"What about the tale from the quay?"
asked the woman in the front passenger seat, whose accent was distinctly German. Floyd had told Auger her name, but she had forgotten it as soon as she saw the boy waiting outside the hotel.
"I don't see anyone," Floyd said, "but you can bet someone's still got their eye on me."
Auger leaned forward. "Someone's following you as well."
"I'm a popular guy."
Floyd parked the car outside the horse meat butcher Auger remembered from her visit that morning. The shop front was covered in a mosaic of red, white, and black tiles, with the figure of a red prancing horse picked out in Romanesque style beneath the words, "Achat de chevaux."
"Floyd," said the German woman, "this is all happening a little too quickly for me."
"It's happening a little too quickly for me as well, if that's any consolation," Floyd replied. "That's why we're all going up to my office to have a nice little chat, and maybe we can sort some of this out."
The German woman looked at Auger with a sneer of disapproval.
"Is she seriously going to walk along the street looking like that?"
"We'll take her upstairs. Let her get clean and dry," Floyd said. "Then I'm sure you won't mind if she borrows some of the clothes you left behind."
"She's welcome to any that will fit her," the woman replied, looking Auger up and down with a less than complimentary eye.
"Thank you," Auger said with an exaggerated smile.
"Ladies, if you're going to start scratching each other's eyes out, could you at least wait until I've had a shot of whiskey? I can't stand violence on an empty stomach."
"Shut up, Floyd," the German woman said.
Floyd got out of the car and went around to the passenger side to open the door for Greta. Auger was already out of the car, looking around for anything she didn't like or that seemed out of place.
but the street was as quiet and sleepy as she remembered it, and even a loitering child would have stood out.
"He wants to talk to you," the German woman said, tapping Floyd's arm and pointing to the shop with the horse sign.
Behind the glass, the proprietor was gesturing at Floyd, waving him inside.
"Monsieur Gosset will have to wait," Floyd said. "He only ever grumbles about the rent or the noise from his upstairs neighbors."
The three of them entered Floyd's building. The elevator that had stalled Auger's exit earlier was waiting for them like an iron trap. They all got in and Floyd pushed one of the brass buttons. With a buzz and a lurch, the car began its climb to the detective's floor.
"I'm still waiting for an explanation, Floyd," the German woman said.
"Maybe I should begin by introducing the two of you properly," Floyd said, putting on a veneer of civility. "Verity Auger, Greta Auerbach. I'm sure the two of you will get along like a house on fire."
"Or something,"
Auger muttered. The elevator came to a stop. Floyd opened the gate and led them onto the landing. Gesturing for them to hang back, he walked to the pebbled glass door that led into his office and examined the gap between the door and the frame just above the lock. He turned back to them with a finger pressed against his lips.
"Something's wrong," he whispered. "I put a hair across this gap before I left this morning. It's not there anymore."
"You think someone's been in there?"
Auger asked. Involuntarily, she touched her hip, feeling for the reassuring presence of the automatic. As tempted as she was to draw the gun now, she didn't want the hole she was in to get any deeper.
"Wait," Floyd said.
Very gently, he tried to turn the doorknob. Auger heard it click against resistance. The door was still locked.
"Maybe the hair blew away," Greta suggested.
"And maybe someone found their way inside with a skeleton key," Floyd replied.
A door a little further down the landing opened a crack, a bar of watery daylight cutting across the carpet. An elderly woman pushed her powdered face into the hall and said in French,
"Monsieur Floyd, you had better come inside, I think."
"Not now, Madame Parmentier," Floyd replied.
"I really think you better had," she said.
Then she stepped back, the door creaking open another few inches. Looming behind her, a fire iron in his hand, was a large man dressed in a vest and braces.
"Christine," Floyd said.
"You'd better listen to the lady," the man said, lowering the fire iron. "I don't think it's safe for us to go into the office. The boys from the big house have this building under heavy surveillance, and every once in a while they send someone inside to see if you're home."
"Come in, please,"
Madame Parmentier insisted. Floyd shrugged and led the way into the woman's apartment. The layout of the rooms was completely different from the offices occupied by the detective, and even to Auger, the decor and ambience suggested that they had stepped back 50 or 60 years into a Paris at the turn of the century. There were no concessions to the modern era, not a wireless set or telephone to be seen, and certainly no television. Even the clockwork phonograph that sat beneath the window looked as if it would have suffered a fit rather than play anything more modern than Debussy. The furniture was upholstered with a maroon velvet plush, the sweeping wooden legs and armrests covered in gold leaf. The interior doorways were framed by pairs of peacock's feathers, tilted like ceremonial scimitars. A brass bird's cage was suspended from the ceiling, but there was no evidence that a bird had ever occupied it. Stationed around the room were at least a dozen antique oil lamps, their tinted glass throwing shades of blue, green, and turquoise onto the immaculate white walls, even though none of them were lit. The room faced south and was drinking in what little remained of the day's light. Madame Parmentier closed the door behind them.
"You cannot stay here long," she said.
"I know," said the man Floyd had referred to as Christine, "and we won't inconvenience you for a moment longer than is necessary. But may we sit down for the time being?"
"Very well," the old lady said. "I suppose I had better make some tea in that case."
They all found seats, while Madame Parmentier pushed her way through a curtain of gleaming glass beads into what Auger presumed was an adjoining kitchen.
"So who wants to start?" Floyd asked, sticking with French. "Right now I don't know where to begin."
"Who's she?" Christine asked, nodding in Auger's direction.
"The sister," Floyd replied.
"Not much of a redhead, is she?"
"We were half sisters," Auger said.
Floyd spread his hands in a gesture of defeat. "What can I say? She's got an answer for everything, Andre.
Every damn question you can throw at her, she's worked it all out. She even had me half believing that a well-bred girl might take to snooping around the tunnels of the Paris Metro.
I told you, Olga began, but abruptly changed tack, addressing Custine.
Anyway, who are you? I've got as much of a right to ask that question of you as you have of me.
This is André Custine, Floyd said, my associate and friend.
An equally hopeless case, Greta added.
Olga looked around at them.
I can't tell whether you like each other or hate each other.
We've been having a trying few days, Floyd replied, before suddenly lowering his voice.
Is it me? Or is there a bad smell in this place? He whispered.
It's me, Custine said cheerfully, or rather the shirt I just removed. How else do you think I got into the building without being picked up?
Monsieur Gosset, Greta said, her face lighting up with understanding. You smell like horse meat.
Floyd buried his head in his hands. It just gets better and better. Of the four of them, Custine was the only one who seemed completely calm and unfazed, as if this was exactly the kind of thing that happened most afternoons.
I'd had enough of Michel's hospitality at Le Perroquet.
He means well, but there's only so long a person can stay sane in that kind of room. Thankfully, he was able to use his contacts to find me temporary lodgings elsewhere, but I needed to return here first, having been in something of a hurry when I dropped by yesterday. But how to enter the building unobserved? He smiled, clearly enjoying the chance to be the center of attention. That was when it hit me. I could kill two birds with one stone. I knew that Gosset received a daily consignment of horse meat from somewhere north of the city. I remembered the name of the delivery firm, and that Gosset owed the agency a favor. A couple of telephone calls later, and I'd secured myself a snug little hideaway in the back of the delivery lorry.
You won't be able to pull tricks like that for much longer, Floyd observed. Sooner or later, they'll be searching every truck in Paris, head to toe.
By then, I hope such subterfuge won't be necessary.
Custine reached up and took a cup and saucer from the tray that Madame Parmentier had just brought into the room. In his huge hands, the delicate chinaware looked like fragile props from a doll's house. Anyway, here I am, although I don't intend to stick around for more than a few hours.
Given any thought as to how you'll get out of the building? Floyd asked.
I'll cross that bridge when it becomes a necessity, Custine said, sipping at the very weak tea. Chances are they'll be expecting me to arrive, not leave, so they may be off their guard.
I like a man who thinks ahead.
Custine aimed one little finger towards Olga.
I only got half the story. You claim to be Susan White's sister, or half-sister, or whatever.
There's no claim about it, Olga said. I am who I said I am. If you and Monsieur Floyd don't like it, that's entirely your problem.
This, incidentally, Floyd said, is what passes for gratitude in Mademoiselle Auger's scheme of things. I was treated to it when I got her out of trouble in the metro station, and again when we were near the hotel.
Custine studied Auger.
What happened near the hotel?
Auger saw something she didn't like, Floyd said. Now she's refusing to talk about it.
Auger sipped at her own tea. The whole setting, with the four of them, not to mention their host, sitting down in these very genteel surroundings, felt ludicrously inappropriate. Less than an hour ago, she had been managing the controlled contraction of a wormhole throat after dispatching a ship back to the real Mars in another part of the galaxy. Now she was balancing chinaware on her knee while sitting primly upright on an old-fashioned upholstered armchair in a room where even the thought of violence seemed incongruous.
I panicked, she said. That's all.
Only when you saw that strange child, Floyd said.
Custine made a low, growling sound before speaking.
What kind of child?
A nasty-looking little boy, Floyd replied, like something from a Bosch painting. Ring any bells, André?
Funnily enough.
Nasty little children have been popping up all over this case, Floyd elaborated. A girl here, a boy there. Maybe more than one of each. We've been trying to discount their significance, but Mademoiselle Auger was spooked by the boy she spotted long before she'd had a good look at him.
Meaning what?
Custine asked. Meaning she was looking out for a child, or something like one, Floyd replied, fixing Auger with a determined gaze.
I told you, Auger said. I simply panicked.
Who are those children? Floyd demanded. What do they have to do with the killings? Who are they working for? More to the point,
Who are you working for?
Excuse me.
Auger put down her cup and saucer and stood up from the armchair. This is all very nice, but... She fumbled for the automatic, sliding it from her waistband. There was a collective intake of breath, even from Christine, as her hand reappeared with the gun. Just for the record, she said, working off the safety catch, I know how to use this. In fact, I've already killed with it today.
Floyd sounded calmer than he looked. So we can dispense with the cover story at long last. Nice girls don't carry guns, especially not automatics.
That's fine, then, because I'm really not a very nice girl.
Auger pointed the gun at Floyd. I don't want to hurt you.
That's good to know. But understand this. I will if I have to.
She sounds as if she means it, Christine said. The low rumble of his voice reminded Auger of a passing train.
Floyd stood slowly from his seat, putting down his own tea.
What do you want?
A change of clothes, that's all.
Floyd glanced at Greta.
Clothes won't be a problem.
Good. Open your office. One of you has a key. Christine was the first to reach slowly into his pocket and tossed a key through the air.
Auger grabbed it with her free hand and tossed it to Floyd.
The rest of you stay here, she ordered. If anyone moves, I'll shoot Wendell. Got that?
No one's going anywhere, Christine said.
Move very slowly, Auger instructed Floyd as she started backing out of the apartment, keeping the gun trained on him. She risked a glance over her shoulder before entering the hallway, but everything was as they had left it, with the elevator still waiting. She backed herself against the wall next to the pebbled glass door.
Go inside, she said, and if you've got a gun in there, don't think of using it.
Floyd answered in English. When they were alone, it made more sense than French. Detectives only have guns in the movies.
You said Greta had left some clothes that would fit me. Find a suitcase and throw the clothes into it.
Floyd unlocked the pebbled glass door.
What sort of clothes?
Don't get cute. Just throw in a selection and let me worry about it later.
Give me a minute.
You've got 30 seconds. Floyd disappeared into the warren of rooms. Auger heard doors being opened and closed in haste, things being thrown around and rummaged through. His voice echoing, he called back, Why don't you tell me what all this is about, now that we're on such excellent terms?
The less you know, the better.
I've heard that too many times in my life to find it satisfying.
Get used to it. This is one time when it definitely applies. What's holding you up?
I'm looking for a suitcase.
A bag will do. Anything. I'm getting impatient here, Wendell. Don't make me impatient.
What color stockings do you like?
Wendell?
It doesn't matter anyway. You'll just have to make do with what you're given.
More doors were opened and shut. She heard things scraping on wood.
Floyd raised his voice again.
So what's next, Auger?
Back to the States, mission accomplished? Or are you not really from the States after all?
All you need to know is that I'm on your side, she said.
That's something, I guess.
And that I'm here to help you, not just you, but you and everyone you know.
And those children, and whoever killed Susan White and Blanchard.
I'm not with them. Hurry up.
You could at least tell me who you're working for. Like it or not, I've helped you now. I didn't have to bail you out in the station.
And I said thanks. For what it's worth, you did the right thing. And if you could see the big picture, you'd agree with me.
So describe the big picture to me.
She tapped the barrel of the automatic against the doorframe. Don't push your luck. Have you found a bag?
Just filling it now.
Auger felt something in her relent. In some small, grudging way, she couldn't help but recognize a kindred spark of stubbornness in Wendell that she knew all too well.
Listen, she said, I'd tell you everything if I knew all of it myself. Well, maybe I wouldn't tell you all of it, but I'd tell you enough to satisfy your curiosity, if that was what you wanted. But the fact is that I haven't got it all figured out yet.
How much did Susan White have figured out?
Not everything, but more than I have, I think.
Let's hope that isn't why she ended up dead.
Susan knew she was onto something big, something worth killing for. I think she was scared by the scale of it.
Were the two of you both working for the same government?
Yes,
Auger said carefully. And it is the United States.
Floyd returned carrying a double-handled canvas bag of dubious condition. It was brimming with clothes, almost all of them black or shades of purple and blue, so close to black as to make no practical difference.
But you were never sisters, were you?
Just colleagues,
Auger said. Now stay put and kick the bag in my direction. He complied. That's good. She picked it up, taking both handles in one hand. Thank your girlfriend for this. I know she wasn't crazy about lending me her clothes, but it'll all be worth it in the end. She kept the gun pointing at Floyd. I'm sorry it had to happen this way. I hope things work out for all of you. Why can't you just tell me everything you know, and let me be the judge? Floyd asked. Because I'm not that cruel. Auger started backing towards the elevator. All right. Here's the deal. I'm leaving now, and I don't want anyone following me. Is that understood?
Understood, Floyd said.
Auger stepped into the elevator car, dropped the bag by her side, and slid shut the trelliswork gate. No funny tricks on the way down this time, all right?
No funny tricks.
Good. She pressed the lowest of the brass buttons. I said it before, but I'll say it again. It's been a pleasure doing business. The car began to descend. Wait, Floyd called, his voice almost drowned out by the whining racket of the elevator. What did you mean by not that cruel? I meant exactly what I said, Auger replied. Goodbye, Wendell. I hope you have a long and fulfilling life.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.